Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, Tuesday, the 6th of May. As always, a very important briefing for you. We have a number of topics. We have Sarah with us from UNDP, who is going to introduce a colleague momentarily. He'll speak to the UNDP New Human Development Report, which is out today. We have colleagues from the Refugee Agency speaking to the situation in Sudan and in Chad, and colleagues from World Health Organization on South Sudan. We also have announcements from the Economic Commission for Europe and the World Meteorological Organization. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Sarah of the UNDP, who will introduce her colleague, who is joining us from New York. So thank you very much for joining us at 4:30 in the morning. We greatly appreciate this encounter. So, Sarah.
Thank you very much. So today, we're launching our new Human Development Report, which is titled A Matter of Choice, People and Possibilities in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. The report analyzes development progress across a range of indicators known as the Human Development Index. And these encompass achievement in health and education along with level of income. So we have with us Heriberto Tapia, who is the head of research for the Human Development Report Office, and he's going to give you the top line. I've sent you all the material on Friday and again this morning, but please reach out to me if you haven't received the report, because I know that some of you, it bounced back. So just reach out. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, colleagues. It's my pleasure to be here. So this year's report, we are bringing the latest update of the Human Development Index and other indicators, but in particular, the Human Development Index. We have projections for the year 2024, and the results are very disappointing. For 2024, we have a positive increase in the Human Development Index, but it is extremely slow. So just to give you a perspective, it's around one-fifth of the typical progress that we had in the years before the pandemic. Also, to give you a little bit of perspective of this disappointing result, is that if we had continued, this is before the pandemic, the trend before the pandemic, by we were projecting by that by 2030 we would be reaching for the world as a whole the category of very high HDI levels. Then of course the pandemic derailed us, but now with this, if this progress in 2024 becomes the new normal, then this milestone of reaching the very high HDI category would be delayed by three decades. So it's very concerning, and this result doesn't take into account what's going on in this 2025. It's all the volatility in terms of the economy in different parts of the world and the new projections that were issued just a few weeks ago. So another concerning point is the increasing inequalities when we compare the performance in terms of human development of the top countries in the world and the bottom countries in the world. Now for 4 years in a row, we have an increase in inequalities, reversing a trend that we had seen in previous decades. So it is in this very disappointing context then we are issuing this report that tackles the issue of artificial intelligence. And something that is a ray of hope is that people, and this is one of the main messages of the report, are embracing artificial intelligence in a relatively positive way. We started this report trying to understand the positive things, the negative things about artificial intelligence. And we see, and because we conducted a survey around 21 countries representing 63% of people around the world. And in this survey, we found that first, people are engaging with the artificial intelligence very significantly. Around 1 in 5 respondents are already using artificial intelligence, but what is very striking is that people expect to use artificial intelligence in a more significant way over just 1 year. So around, for instance, in developing countries, around 2/3 of the respondents expect to use artificial intelligence in just 1 year. So this is very encouraging. At the same time, people expect that artificial intelligence might automate their works. Around half of the respondents expect this, but even a larger number, around 60%, expect that artificial intelligence will create new opportunities for them. And the report explores the conditions under which could be possible. The report doesn't make a prediction, but the report talks about the choices that are available to realize a better future. And the conditions that the report emphasizes is, one, to strengthen a complementary economy, precisely where people are not replaced by machines, but rather where machines and people can interact together to support human development. And the report provides some conditions for this to happen. Second, to push innovation for intent. This means that the new waves of innovation has to be oriented precisely towards complementing the work of people and not to replace them. And this is very important, for instance, in how we develop the benchmark. How do we define a successful wave of new artificial intelligence? And third, investing in the capabilities that count, in particular, because people need to be better prepared to deal with this complementary economy. And we have, fortunately, evidence that artificial intelligence can be used to personalize educational services, health services, and so on. So I'm going to stop here. Happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tapia. Do we have questions for our colleague from UNDP? Starting in the room. No, nor online. So I think you were very, very comprehensive, and thank you very much, Sarah, for joining us as well. Sarah, thank you again for joining us so early. Good luck today with the launch of this very important report. So we'll move on to the next subject as Eugene from UNHCR makes her way up here. And she is going to introduce a colleague from UNHCR who's joining us from N'Djamena, who's going to talk about the Sudanese influx into Chad. So Eugene, over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm presenting our representative in Chad, who is connected from N'Djamena, who can present to you about the new arrival from Darfur region, specifically in El Fasher and around in the Zamjan camp, that we're receiving tens of thousands of Sudanese crossing the border to Chad last 2 weeks. So you can hear more detail from our representative in Chad. Over to you, Magat.
Thank you. Thank you, Eugene. Do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you well.
Yes. My name is Magat Gisey Yunecha, representative. Thank you for having me.
Sorry, sir, may I just interrupt? If it's possible, I don't know if you can put on your video. It would be preferable, I think, for our journalist here. If it's a connectivity issue, then please. But if you could maybe try to put your video on. Sorry to interrupt you.
Can you see me?
Yes, perfect. Good image. Thank you very much, sir. Okay. Please continue.
Yes, and sorry for the noise you have behind me because our electricity is off and we have a big generator, you know, making a big noise. So again, my name is Magat Gisey Yunecha, representative in Chad, and thanks for having me again here. This Sudanese influx, as we speak, has created an alarming situation in the northeastern Chad. The UNHCR Refugee Agency is gravely concerned by the rapidly increasing number of Sudanese refugees crossing into eastern Chad, with more than 18,500 and reaching, at the time we are talking now, to 20,000 people, mostly exhausted and traumatized women and children arriving in the past 2 weeks alone. The sharpest rise has been recorded at the Tine border crossing in Wadi Fira province, where almost 6,000 arrived in just 2 days. Since 21st of April, a total of over 14,000 individuals have been counted in Wadi Fira, including 12,000 in the last 7 days, but also 5,300 people in NAD East over the past 2 weeks, including 1,000 in just yesterday. This sudden influx reflects the escalating violence in Sudanese North Darfur region, particularly in and around Al-Fashir, which is triggering mass displacement at an alarming pace. The latest movement follows brutal attacks by armed groups in North Darfur, where assaults on displacement camps, including Zamzam and Abu Shoub and Al-Fashir town, have caused widespread terror. Refugees arriving in Chad report that over 10,000 people are still on their way to Chad, desperately trying to cross the border to escape the violence. Many of the newly arrived refugees report experiencing grave violence and human rights violations that force them to flee. They describe men being killed, women and girls subjected to sexual violence, and homes burned to the ground. The journey to safely were perilous, with refugees facing robbery and extortion at checkpoints and repeated threats along the way. Most arrived in Chad with nothing, no money, no food, or identification. Several wounded individuals, including children and elderly women, reportedly fell from vehicle during the chaotic escape. A rapid protection assessment by UNHCR and its partners indicates that 76% of the newly arrived refugees were subjected to serious protection incidents, including extortion, theft, and sexual violence. At the same time, our protection team at the border point have identified increasing number of people with specific needs, including 752 at-risk children, 22 of whom were injured in the conflict, as well as unaccompanied children, pregnant and breastfeeding women, and elderly survivors. Despite extraordinary effort by local community and authorities, the capacity to absorb the new arrival is severely overstretched. Chad is already hosting 1.3 million refugees, including 794,000 new arrivals from Sudan since the conflict started more than 2 years ago. While the country continues to show remarkable solidarity in hosting refugees, it cannot bear this burden alone. Humanitarian resources across the country remains extremely limited, while needs continue to grow: water, shelter, health, education, and protection. Since 23 April, aid convoy have relocated almost 1,850 newly arrived refugees to Iridimi, a site in Wadi Fira province. UNHCR and its partners are delivering life-saving assistance both at the border point and relocation site, but current efforts remain far from sufficient given the scale of the crisis. Attacks on civilians must end in Sudan, and safe passage needs to be allowed to those attempting to flee to save their life. In the absence of peace, UNHCR urged the international community to urgently step up support for the response. Over the $409 million required to respond to the refugee crisis in Chad this year, only 20% have been funded today. We urgently call for increased solidarity and immediate funding to ensure this vulnerable population receive the protection and assistance they need now. I will stop here, and je serai à votre disposition pour répondre aux éventuelles questions que vous avez. Merci beaucoup.
Merci à vous, Monsieur Guise. Thank you very much for your intervention. Questions for our colleague from UNHCR. Okay. Notes. Okay. Yes, indeed. If you could share your notes, maybe Eugene is that's on the way. Let me just take this opportunity. Of course, as you just heard from Mr. Geese eloquently, attacks must end. Safe passage. These are the exact calls that the Secretary General has been pronouncing, especially since the new resume fighting. We strongly condemn the fighting in Sudan. And we obviously call for an urgent dialogue between the parties to end this horrific conflict. So with that, we'll take a question from Agnès from Agence France-Presse, AFP. Over to you, Agnès.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I don't know if I should ask the question in French or in English. I will go in English. So, it's about the figure. It wasn't clear to me how many people have left over the last 2 weeks. If it's 20,000 or if it's 18,500. It wasn't clear to me. If you could clarify that, thank you.
Yes, let's consider 20,000 because we registered 18,500, but since yesterday, moving to today, we are heading to 20,000. From this call, we can consider 20,000 people.
And I understand there's a lot of numbers, so we will immediately send a note which includes all the numbers that you need.
Thank you both. Further questions? Yes, Nina, AFP.
Sorry, I had a question on Sudan specifically. I don't know. It's about Port Sudan and the attacks there. I was just wondering if anyone here could talk about the situation there, the numbers of how it's impacting UN operations there, because a lot of and how many workers the UN has there. I would be interested in any information you have on that. And it could also be how it's impacting the inflow into Chad also. Thank you.
Sure. Maybe what I'll do, Nina, just to start us off, if any other colleagues want to chime in, please do. I think Jens might have something. I'm not sure, but I can just repeat what our spokesperson in New York uttered yesterday. And of course, we're extremely concerned about these recent the reports of these attacks in Port Sudan. Port Sudan, up until recently, had been escaped the violence, the attacks, which has plagued the large parts of the country. This is a very worrying development. I mean, of course, as we just heard from our colleague from UNHCR, the protection of civilians and our humanitarian operations remains a priority. We have a massive concentration of our colleagues working in Port Sudan, again, which has been spared from most of this violence. So we're obviously monitoring the situation very closely. And of course, this is another opportunity for me to echo what the Secretary General has been saying to renew his call for urgent dialogue between the warring parties, the immediate cessation of hostilities, and an inclusive political process to prevent further escalation, to protect civilians, and put Sudan back on the path towards peace and stability. So if any colleagues have anything to add about numbers, we can come back to you on that, Nina. I'm not sure. I don't have those figures in front of me, but certainly over the course of the day, we'll try to gather that and of course, keep you updated on the developments of these attacks. Thank you. Further questions, maybe on Sudan, because we're going to switch south to South Sudan in a moment, but we want to stick on Sudan for the moment. No, I don't see that's the case. So I'd like to thank you, Mr. Geese. Thank you very, very much for your intervention and for the amazing work you're doing there and to you and your colleagues. So thank you so much for joining us here. Margaret.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'm calling Margaret to the podium here to join me. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization is going to introduce her colleague who's joining us from Juba in South Sudan, who will talk specifically about the escalating attacks on health in that country, in South Sudan. So, Margaret, over to you.
Nice to be with you and introducing our new colleague. Sorry, down, thank you. No, it's always good to get my microphone hygiene right. A relatively new colleague, hasn't spoken to you before. He's our representative from South Sudan who is coming to talk about the severe health problems there, but particularly the escalating health attacks in attacks on health in South Sudan. Dr. Kab- is he
Dr. Karamagai.
Dr. Karabagi, is he on the line?
Sorry. Yes, doctor, over to you.
Yes, I'm okay. Here.
Great.
Welcome. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you can hear me well.
We can. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you again for this opportunity. I'll just give some background before going into what is going on and what actions are needed. Since its independence in 2011, South Sudan has grappled with a complex, protracted humanitarian crisis that is characterized currently by food insecurity, malnutrition, displacement, and erosion of basic livelihoods of the people. Since beginning of this year, however, this crisis has been heightened because of political tension in the country. This is particularly in one of the states, which is the Upper Nile State, where there have been clashes between the government forces and armed groups. It has led to worsening suffering and deaths, with forced displacement of an estimated 80,000 people in three of the most affected counties within the state. Clashes have also been reported in other parts of the country, in other states, but most of the current issues are centered in Upper Nile State. And this has forced people, a lot of our women and children, to flee into neighboring countries. So far, we have recorded over 23,000 refugees fleeing into Ethiopia, for instance. What is very concerning in addition to this is the violence against health facilities, which we have noted in this current conflict. Since January 2025, we have documented 8 separate incidents of attacks on health facilities, with health workers killed, facilities and essential supplies looted or destroyed. There have been assaults on humanitarian convoys too, and the destruction of cold chain infrastructure, which makes delivery of essential services and vaccines very difficult. The latest incident, which happened over the weekend, was a bombing of a main hospital in Old Fangak town. This was on the 3rd of May, and led to multiple deaths and the closure of this critical hospital, which is serving over 110,000 people. These events have direct impacts on the access to health services for thousands of civilians who are already struggling with multiple vulnerabilities. Every time this happens, people lose access to health services and sometimes to hope, because each incident strips thousands of people of their only lifeline and livelihoods. Provision of basic essential services therefore continues to be challenged in the country. And all this is happening as we are grappling with a large cholera outbreak. In the past 6 months of the outbreak, that's from September to currently, we have identified over 55,000 cholera cases and just over 1,000 deaths. The insecurity and population displacements and the attacks on the health facilities makes the management of cholera, plus the other outbreaks which we are grappling with, such as malaria, mpox, measles, anthrax, hepatitis E, a lot more complex for us to respond to. WHO is responding to the crisis in South Sudan at all levels. We have raised the grading of South Sudan to the highest priority emergency level, which is grade 3, which means that we are now mobilizing our support and resources at the country, regional, and global levels. This activation has enabled rapid provision of direct operational support. We've been able to deploy rapid response teams. We've been able to preposition medical supplies closer to where the outbreaks are happening, so that once there is an event, we're able to quickly provide the services that people require. And all this, we are doing it working side by side with our very diligent colleagues in the National Ministry of Health and other humanitarian partners. The alternative, if we do nothing, would be bleak for the people of South Sudan. We are expecting that cholera cases, for instance, may double within the next 6 weeks because of the onset of the rains. And so disruptions to services during such a situation is quite catastrophic. We are expecting the measles deaths to go up over 40% if we are not able to respond to the measles cases we are having. We expect that if there are more attacks on health facilities, more than half of the health facilities along the River Nile may have to close or to reduce functionality, because the safety of our health workers is really paramount. And also we are unable to take supplies in a conflict situation. This is why we're asking for your support. We need to raise the profile of this issue and the effect that it's having on the people. We need to sustain the essential health response operations throughout the coming rainy seasons, which will take us until November this year. We need strong political support to protect our health workers and facilities through diplomatic engagement and accountability mechanisms. And we also need to engage local support systems within the country through investments in the frontline capacities of our civil society, NGO partners, and other community-based actors. The people of South Sudan are quite resilient. They've gone through a lot so far, but they cannot face this alone. Health is their last safety net. If health fails, then everything else fails. So our plea is that you help us to make sure that this does not happen, and that we can at least do something to ease the suffering of the people in this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Karamagi. Message well received. Do we have questions for our colleague from WHO starting in the room? I don't see any hands up nor online. I think you were very comprehensive, sir, and I thank you very much for shedding light on this story, somewhat overshadowed by so many others, but thank you, colleagues, for reporting. Do we have a question, or maybe for Margaret? Okay. I think, is it on South Sudan or another subject? Okay. All right. In that case, just to mention that, of course, you will have seen the statements from the humanitarian coordinator, Marie-Hélène Vernet, who's humanitarian coordinator for South Sudan, who echoed the same sentiments of our colleague from WHO and deploring these deadly airstrikes in a jungle state on the hospital, and of course calling for the end to fighting and access for humanitarian teams, as we've been saying for many, many months now and years. So thank you very much, sir, for joining us. And in that, since we have Margaret here, Nina, your question for Margaret.
Thank you. Hi, Margaret. I had a question about President Trump's executive order yesterday, limiting research grants for gain-of-function research on pathogens. I was wondering what the impact of that order will be, and also how concerned WHO is about the Trump administration pushing the narrative that COVID was created from a lab leak, and that this executive order will sort of reinforce that. If you have anything on that, thank you.
I don't have anything specific on that executive order. I haven't seen it. We haven't had a chance to digest that. I actually don't have any information on that. On COVID, as you know, all options are on the table. All the theories are still on the table, and they're still being reviewed.
Thank you, Margaret. Do we have further questions for Margaret before I release her? Nope. You're free.
And just to say, the notes from Dr. Humphrey Karamagi are being sent.
Thank you. Wonderful. Yeah, that's very important. Thank you to you and again to Dr. Karamagi. Okay, moving on to UNIC. If we can have our guests from UNIC join us here. And afterwards, we have also Claire online, who's going to address an important report from the WMO. Give us a sec.
Good morning, colleagues. Thank you for having us today. And just before I go on with our announcement, let me just introduce my colleague, Stephanie Schumacher-Devec, who is Communication Officer at the Office of the UN Special Envoy for Road Safety. So on the eve of the 8th UN Road Safety Week, the United Nations Special Envoy for Road Safety, Jean Todt, with support of the Permanent Representation of Malaysia, We launched the UN Road Safety Exhibition. The exhibition will be launched here at the Palais des Nations e-building on Friday, 9th of May, starting at 1 and ending at 2:30. The exhibition aims to raise awareness about the risk factors on the road and to demonstrate the importance of applying the existing solutions that can improve road safety and save millions of lives. The exhibition in particular will feature the Helmets for Hope project, displaying 17 helmets that comply with UN safety standards, which are negotiated at UNECE, and painted by refugees and artists from all over the world. And here we can show you an example of a painted helmet compliant with UN standards that you will be able to see on Friday at the exhibition. Motorcycle users are particularly vulnerable on the road, and wearing a helmet that complies with UN safety standards is a game changer. It can reduce the risk of death by over 6 times and reduce the risk of brain injury by up to 74%. It is therefore urgent to promote the widespread use of UN-certified helmets, as UNEC and Special Envoy keep reminding us. The exhibition on Friday will also feature 17 visuals of the UN Global Campaign for Road Safety, which is called Make a Safety Statement, as well as 2 vehicle safety demonstrations, which will take place on the parking just in front of the e-building. One of these demonstrations will be on preventing and managing road crashes, including extinguishing battery fire. And the other one will be a simulation test of driving tired and under the influence. Just to remind you, every year, road-related fatalities claim the lives of 1.19 million people around the globe, leaving 50 million others with severe injuries. Furthermore, road crashes are the leading cause of death for children and young adults aged 5 to 29 years, years old. Pedestrians and cyclists account for over 300,000 road traffic deaths a year, making them one of the most vulnerable category of road users. As the custodian of UN road safety legal instruments and the Global Forum for Development of Vehicle Regulations, UNEC is working to improve the safety of all road users, minimize and eventually eliminate road crash trauma. It does so in close cooperation with the Special Envoy for Road Safety and the UN Road Safety Fund, as well as other relevant stakeholders and partners. The campaign, Make a Safety Statement, which you will be able to see on Friday, is done in partnership with the company JCDECA, is part of UN efforts to raise public awareness of life-saving behavior on the road. By the end of this year, the campaign will appear on billboards and in public places in 80 countries. It will be broadcast in about 1,000 towns, cities in 30 languages. The campaign brings together international celebrities such as actor Patrick Dempsey, Michelle Yeoh, racer Charles Leclerc, athlete Didier Drogba, Teddy Riner, singer Kylie Minogue, and another athlete, Mick Schumacher, as well as Naomi Campbell. They encourage road users to adopt simple but effective rules to keep them safe on the road. And as the main theme of this year's UN Road Safety Week focuses on making walking and cycling safe, the Office of the Special Envoy for Road Safety has strengthened its partnership and cooperation with International Union of Cyclists, as well as cyclist Tadej Pogacar, who is one of the champions of the Make a Safety Statement campaign. If you have any questions, Stephanie, my colleague, will be happy to provide further precisions, as well as myself. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jovana. Questions? For either Ms. Schumacher or
maybe Stephanie can also show the
Please
the helmet.
Yes, Stephanie, please. Yeah.
Now this is the helmet responding to the UN standards, which are very important because we know that the motorcyclists are the most of the vulnerable on the road. So this is what also the special envoy is doing when he's travel all over the world, meeting governments and meeting also private sector. Is trying to promote this type of helmets, encourage to use these helmets on the road. So very important helmets. And so we have this work with the artists to raise awareness about road safety. Related to the campaign, I just would like to add that the campaign has been displayed in more than 50 countries so far. So it's a very successful campaign, and to be continued to the next year, thanks to the support of these celebrities, but also with the support of the Olympic International Committee. We also engage with the sport community to sensibilize and to raise awareness about road safety.
Thank you both very much. Incredibly important development, so congratulations on that. And do we have questions? No, I don't see any questions. Again, I think you're very shy today, colleagues. But thank you very much for being here, and thank you very much for bringing these beautiful props. Good luck. The exhibition is Friday. Excellent. Okay, and it's at the E-Building. Very good. Colleagues, make sure you get there. Thank you both very much again for this very, very important initiative, which is indeed global. Thank you. Who do we have now? We have Claire of Nullis of WMO, who's on the line, who's going to speak to WMO State of Climate in Africa report, which is to be released in the coming days. So, Claire, over to you.
Yes, good morning, everybody. The World Meteorological Organization is continuing with its spate of regional reports on the state of the climate. Africa is the next one. We will be releasing that, the State of the Climate in Africa 2024 report, on Monday, the 12th of May. There will be a hybrid event with the main launch in Addis Ababa. We will be sending out details of that and obviously the embargoed press release. We are organizing a technical level, and I stress it's quite technical, briefing mainly aimed at African journalists. It's an online briefing which will be held on this Thursday, the 8th of May, and I will send you the details of that, the link, if you wish to sign up to that. I'm stressing, you know, it will be quite a technical level briefing with one of our scientists from our regional Africa office for Africa. So it won't be our Secretary General. She's traveling at the moment. We have a couple more reports coming up. The State of the Climate in the Southwest Pacific, that is scheduled for the first week in June, but we will send out a, you know, media advisory with more details on that in the coming days. That's all from me. Thank you.
Super. Thanks very much, Claire, for those updates and putting these important events on our radar. So do we have questions? Any specific questions for Claire? No? Okay. Well, we're nearly done. Is that for me or for somebody else? If Jens, I know. I do have a couple announced, but maybe I'll wait to pronounce those as Jens settles in here. We'll take your question, Nina. Okay, over to you.
Hi, Jens. Thanks for coming up. I had a few questions on the situation in Gaza and the concerns around Israel's conquest plan and moving the population, and in particular the discussions around shutting down existing distribution systems in Gaza and taking them over. If you could provide some details on what the impact of those plans would be if they're implemented. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nina, and good morning, everyone. It is correct that the Israeli authorities have provided the humanitarian country team working in the occupied Palestinian territory with a verbal update on their proposed plans. Now, this plan has caused a reaction from that humanitarian country team, which consists of about 15 UN agencies and around 200 NGOs, who for very long, as you know, have been struggling with providing aid in Gaza. And their reaction to this verbal update that they got was that Israeli officials have sought to shut down the existing aid system, which is run by the aforementioned 15 agencies and 200 NGOs, plus other partners. And the Israelis have asked them to instead deliver supplies through Israeli hubs under conditions set by the Israeli military once the Israeli government agrees to reopen the crossings, which have, as you know, been closed for now 9 weeks. This has caused us to say that we do not accept a proposal and a plan that does not live up to the core fundamental humanitarian principles of impartiality, neutrality, and independent delivery of aid. And what they were presented with appears designed to further control and restrict supplies, which is the opposite of what is needed. Our teams, of course, remain in Gaza and in the region, and we are ready to resume the deliveries of our programs and the desperately needed aid to people as soon as the border crossings open again. And that is, of course, what we have been asking for now 9 weeks. There's a desperate need for food getting in. They're getting bombs. They need water. They're getting bombs. They need health care. They're getting bombs. They need shelter. They're getting bombs, and so on and so forth. So, of course, we need a resumption of the border crossings. We have aid pre-positioned outside of Gaza, ready to go in. So that needs to get in as soon as possible. So that is what I can say about the status of those discussions.
Thank you, Jens. Okay, a few hands up in the room and online. So we'll start maybe Nina and then to Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jens, for that. I was wondering also I also asked about the movement of the order to move, I guess, most of the population. And given the very dire situation that you were just describing, you know, how do you see that impacting the humanitarian situation? And is there any way for humanitarians on the ground to actually respond given the restrictions that you're facing?
Well, these forced relocations of people is not helpful, obviously. You need to know where people are in order to be able to provide aid to them. So on the principle of that, you know, it's another blow. It's another blow. We'll see if people actually move or not. The bottom line is that there's no aid to distribute anymore because the aid operation has been strangled by the closures. Yeah.
Okay, Jeremy, and then Christian.
We've been reporting that for days and weeks now that no aid is coming through. Supplies have all terminated, basically. There's no supplies, nothing coming in Gaza. I'd like to know what kind of food is there left. Now, in Gaza, we're talking about 2 million people starving. Is there any food left in the Gaza Strip? What kind of food is there?
What we have heard from our partners working in the food sector is that they have distributed all they had. So there's no more to give. We have also heard from our colleagues on the ground that they observe people rummaging through garbage, trying to find something edible. So that is the harsh, brutal, inhuman reality of the situation.
Christian.
Yes, Jens, hello. If I understand correctly, the UN would not join any scheme that is run under those plans outlined by the Israeli government, correct? So if they still go ahead with American suppliers, or if they try and do their own distribution, can you give us a sense of how much of the aid that did reach the Gaza Strip, how much of the total when the crossings were open was actually coming from the UN or was coordinated by the UN? And just to get an idea of the feasibility of trying to organize this outside the UN. And do you think it's possible to serve 2 million people with aid outside the UN system? Thank you.
Thank you. Of course, when the borders were, or the crossings were open, and we were able to distribute, the United Nations and all the agencies involved, including UNRWA and others, of course, was a major, major player in providing the aid through that multilateral mechanism. It has to be said also that there was bilateral aid going in, not least through the Rafah crossing, when that was opened, directly from countries and communities outside of Gaza who got money or aid together and put them on trucks and drove them in. So that is not UN aid per se. Exactly how much was UN and how much was un-UN, I simply do not have that overall number. But I think it is fair to say that the UN was and has been the main aid provider throughout this crisis. I'm not inclined to speculate what is possible and what is not possible without the UN. We think that we have meticulously, against all odds, actually enabled an aid system inside Gaza in the worst possible conditions that actually worked and saved lives and provided health care and saw vaccination rounds happening across the strip, as you recall. When the conditions are right, when the crossings are open, when the movement inside the strip is facilitated, it is possible, it is feasible, the UN can absolutely do it. So I think that's the bottom line. And that is, of course, the great frustration of all this, that it is possible and it can be done impartially, neutrally, and independently, and based on humanity, which is addressing human suffering wherever it is found.
Thank you very much, Jens. And maybe just speaking specifically to UNRWA, as you referred to UNRWA, which is, as we've referred to that organization, as the backbone of our work in the Gaza Strip and in the occupied Palestinian territory. I mean, the UNRWA is mandated by the UN General Assembly, by member states, to provide public like services like education, social support, primary health care, all these issues which we speak to here. There's no plan B for UNRWA. Absolutely not. Israel must allow UNRWA to operate without impediment. It's irreplaceable. Palestinians trust UNRWA. Humanitarians trust UNRWA. No other entity has the capacity to deliver the life-saving aid at that scale and social services in breadth needed in Gaza. So I just need to repeat what we've been saying about our colleagues working in country. Who do we go to? We have Jamie, and then AFP, then we have two questions online. So Jamie first, go ahead.
Thank you, Rolando. I also have a question for Margaret, if in the meantime she wants to come up, about the health situation in Gaza. Jens, you mentioned the oral update. I just wanted to make sure when that happened, and is that a continuing process, or is it a specific one instance? I mean, presumably there should be some communication on a regular basis. But with regard to the aid deliveries. Second is for you is about whether or not you have familiarity with a COGAT memo that has to do with about 60 trucks that might be going through Kerem Shalom. I'm just wondering, from your point of view, whether or not, given the fact that there's been no aid getting in at all in the last couple of months, that whether 60 trucks, while probably insufficient in your view, is better than nothing. I mean, would you make that assessment? And then finally, I just wanted to ask, the spokesperson in New York yesterday made a reference to the fact that if I can just quote from it, said that this policy contravenes fundamental humanitarian principles and appears designed to reinforce control over life-saving items as a pressure tactic as part of a military strategy. So can we translate that a little bit and try to understand exactly what that means? For example, how concerned are you that aid, food, and other supplies are being used as a tool of war or of forced displacement by driving people towards Rafah, and even what some might say amounts to ethnic cleansing? Thanks.
Thanks, Jamie. Let me see if I can remember all of that. To take the last one first, it appears to be a deliberate attempt to weaponize the aid. And we have warned against that for a very long time, that aid should be provided based on humanitarian need to whomever needs it, targeting those who need it most first, and not be used as in any way as a tactic to move people to any particular place or to convince people to do this, that, or the other. It is to cover their basic life-saving needs, punto, and nothing else. And that is what is kind of a core of principled humanitarian assistance, that it's given based on their needs, and nothing else, nothing else. And it is done in a neutral manner, without in any way taking sides in the conflict. Of course, we are not doing that. We have only the purpose of helping those in need who are there. Of course, we look at what are the circumstances of what is going on, and that's where we have very little power of itself. But we will have to ask others to do their jobs. We will have to ask the political actors to please give us a ceasefire. Now the bombing is starting again. We are asking those who are holding hostages, release those hostages. The hostage families are suffering tremendously. It is, of course, a horrible crime of war to take hostages in this way and use them as some kind of bargaining chip. On the other hand, you can also not withhold aid to civilians as a bargaining chip on the other side of the board game. It's cruel, and it's certainly not humanitarian. Now, about the trucks, the problem that is currently in Gaza is that even those crossings that are officially closed. Even if trucks are getting through to them, we can't reach them. For security reasons, mainly. So it can't be picked up if things come in. About the when the update happened, I'll have to ask about the specific date and if it was one or it was over several sessions. I do not have the specifics of that. I believe last week, but I will check on that. And I think that was the questions for me.
I think you've covered it all. Maybe yes, is that satisfied, Jamie? Yes. Let's move on to Margaret, and then we have other questions, perhaps for Jens. So,
yeah. Margaret. Just Margaret, I wanted to just know what your latest information is about the levels of malnutrition and possibly famine. There's been word about famine in some instances. Could you just give us the latest update from a health perspective?
Certainly. The IPC analysis is ongoing, and they're likely to report soon, but not yet. So, and they are the group, as you know, who determine the levels of famine and the levels of starvation. But we do know that since the beginning of 2025, nearly 10,000 children with global acute malnutrition, and that includes 1,397 with severe acute malnutrition, have been admitted for outpatient and inpatient treatment. We are also seeing a lot of children with severe acute malnutrition with medical complications. And once you get to that stage, without treatment, you will die. Now, we are actually seeing in the hospitals, in the centres, we've got 3 out of 4 centres functioning for severe acute malnutrition treatment. The one at the Indonesian hospital is no longer functioning. But we're actually seeing fewer cases of children coming into those hospitals for treatment than we expect, given those numbers. And we think that's because simply they're not getting to the centres. They're not getting the access to the care, because we also know that 1 in 5 children don't complete their treatment, and that's usually because of evacuation orders, displacement, the absolutely chaotic situation they're living in. And we're also very, very concerned about the rise in acute watery diarrhoea, because that complicates a child who's already on the brink of starvation. If they develop diarrhea, that will kill them. And we, due to the lack of water and the lack of sewerage infrastructure, we're seeing acute watery diarrhoea everywhere. We're also seeing a big rise in skin diseases, simply because people do not have the water to wash themselves with.
Thank you very much for that, Margaret. Okay, let's move on to the next. We'll really need to, the others have been waiting, so if you want to follow up, Jamie, you can come back. I think, Nina, did you have your hand up? No, you didn't. Agnes.
Yeah, in fact, Jamie asked part of my question. It was about the timing of when you receive the notifications or the announcement, the communications on the plan. If you could, I understand you don't know when the oral verbal update was made, but when the initial plan was proposed. Do you have that date? The first one?
I'm not sure which plan, initial plan you're referring to. There has been a verbal update about this, what's called the humanitarian aid mechanism or something. I don't think it hasn't been shared in writing with anyone, frankly. So it's a verbal update, and that is what I'm trying to get a date for you so you can pin that down.
Thank you. 2 more questions online. Okay, Imogen, BBC. Imogen?
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, good. This is for Jens. I wonder, Jens, just because we need to report this to people who may not quite understand it as well as we do in Geneva. This whole issue of neutrality, impartiality, practically, why are you insisting this is vital? I have to stick to that. You've got 2.2 million people in Gaza who have nothing. And Israel are saying we're going to organize the aid, the UN, you can come and partner with us. Why is that such a no-go?
Thank you, Imogen. Because the mechanism or the proposal as presented to us does not live up to those core principles of, let me take impartiality first, where aid is provided based on needs alone. It's not based on trying to getting people to go somewhere. It's not based on anything else than humanitarian needs alone. The plan does not provide for that. Secondly, and I would put two together, being neutral and being independent. And it's extremely important, particularly for those who are receiving the aid, that they see that it is a neutral go-between, if you like, a neutral provider that they have nothing to fear from, because they are neither for nor against any of the parties doing the fighting. That is extremely important to have that confidence and have that knowledge. Because if you don't, you risk that those providing the aid and those receiving it will be subject to some kind of retaliation, maybe targeted. If one party to a conflict thinks that the provider of aid is providing only to the other side of the conflict, they may consider it, well, then that's a target. And it's to avoid that whole thing that we insist on it being completely neutral in the conflict that creates the needs, and also operationally independent. That's why we have the UN humanitarian system set up, which is very large and very professional and can do these things and do these things all across the world, as you all know.
Thank you very much, Jens. Okay, let's go to one last question online. Kuna Imen, Kuwait News Agency. Imen.
Thank you. A very good question, actually. In the first stage of the war, there was this airdropping of the aid, and it was really risky and dangerous. And UN, I think, described it as a very dangerous way to provide aid in Gaza. But did the UN negotiate with some countries with Israel? I know that Israel is refusing completely every way, let's say, to enter aid, even the airdropping. But is the UN negotiating with other countries about this solution, even if is risky? Thank you.
Thank you. If I understand your question correctly, the UN negotiate with the occupying power, Israel, with whom we have to negotiate because they have the control of the area. So, of course, we engage and have engaged since day one and do it on a daily basis with the Israeli authorities to be able to provide aid. We have systems, notification systems, where we notify them of our movements, we notify them where we are, so everybody is aware what is humanitarian, and so on and so forth. So there is a system. I'm not saying that it works very well, because it doesn't. If we see, again, the movements we have been trying to do over the past week or so, more than half have been denied. It's certainly far from perfect, but that does not mean that we walk away from it. It means that we double down on it and say it has to work.
Thank you very much, Jens, and colleagues, for your questions. Further questions before we have maybe an update shifting back to Sudan, if I may. I think Jens has some additional information per your previous question. I think it was Nina. Yep. Go ahead, Jens.
Yeah, thank you. Just Nina, because there has been questions about what we're seeing in Sudan and in Port Sudan this morning. And what I can say is that we're, of course, aware of the reported drone attacks in the early morning hours of today, targeting Port Sudan International Airport and a fuel storage facility in the transit area of Port Sudan. We also have unconfirmed reports that indicate that other critical infrastructure in the city have been targeted. Port Sudan Airport is a lifeline for humanitarian operations, serving as the primary entry point for aid personnel, medical supplies, and other life-saving relief that is coming into Sudan. So such attacks further increase the already severe access and logistical challenges facing humanitarian actors across the country, and these attacks are in violation of international humanitarian law. This has been going on for some time. As you saw, I think you someone referred to what was said at the noon briefing yesterday, where we also spoke about this. We are still assessing the situation now with these new attacks. What the implications are for that? What I do know was yesterday, because of the attacks on the airport, the humanitarian air service. That you know that we depend on for moving people and supplies around was put on hold. So there was no air service there, at least yesterday. And I cannot imagine that it's up and running right now when we see renewed attacks on the airport.
Thank you, Jens. And no doubt we'll keep you updated on developments in Port Sudan. Jamie, yeah?
Yep. Very quickly, thank you to Nina for asking the question. I just wanted to ask you, you said that it's, I've forgotten the actual term that you used, that it's a critical point for, the lifeline is the way you used it. Can you quantify how important Port Sudan is towards the overall sort of UN humanitarian? I mean, presumably there's also aid coming in through across borders from other countries, you know, Chad, I mean, insofar as possible, I guess, or whatever, maybe Egypt. But you know, how important is Port Sudan to the overall sort of percentage-wise?
Yeah, I mean, it's immensely important. It's immensely important. I think across from cross border, we only have the Adre crossing in Chad. That's it, right? Very important because it goes to Darfur, which is really a flashpoint here. But otherwise, Port Sudan, that's pretty much it. The airport and the port itself, of course, because you can take much larger quantities in by vessel than you can by plane. So it's very concerning.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jens. Okay, Nina, go ahead.
I just wanted to check, Jens, if you had any numbers on the numbers of humanitarians who are there and the impact on the operations specifically of those humanitarians in Port Sudan.
So humanitarians in Port Sudan or humanitarians in Sudan? In Port Sudan. I do not, but I can ask... are you talking about UN only or the broader UN plus NGO community?
Whatever you have.
Whatever I have. All right. It's depend on what kind of question. And I will try to get you the numbers at humanitarian speed.
There you go. All right. Yeah. Thank you for that in advance for those numbers. I don't think we have further questions for Jens. You are released. Thank you very much. Okay, colleagues, just a couple of announcements as usual, and then we'll wrap it up. Just to note that the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, is currently in Copenhagen. He is attending the biannual session of the UN System Chief Executive Board for Coordination, also known as the CEB. And this brings together, as you know, the heads of UN system organizations. So they're there. He's there for today and throughout the week, in fact. He's scheduled to meet with the Prime Minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, will take part in a dinner hosted by their majesties, the King and Queen of Denmark, this evening. And no doubt there will be lots of other important issues which have been discussed here on this podium that will be discussed by the heads of agencies with our boss at this important gathering. One moment. Just to want to make sure that you've seen the statement we issued yesterday on India and Pakistan's situation there is certainly very concerning, and we have issued a statement with regard to the attacks of the 22 April and the developments there since. So that's a statement we shared with you yesterday afternoon. In terms of meetings here at the Palais, we have the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination will close its 115th session this Friday, the 9th of May, at which time they will adopt their reports for the countries they reviewed during the session: Ukraine, Mauritius, the Republic of Korea, Gabon, and Kyrgyzstan. And the Conference on Disarmament will officially kick off the second part of its 2025 session on Monday, this coming Monday the 12th, and this is under the presidency of Kazakhstan. So we'll give you more details on that later. The UPR, the Universal Periodic Review session, as you know, is still underway. Started last Monday, and today, Turkey and Guyana are being reviewed by the UPR's working group. And tomorrow it's Kuwait, and then they'll wrap up their session this coming Friday. And lastly, press conferences. We've sent you the advisory in this room on Friday the 9th, this coming Friday the 9th at 12 noon. We have the Basel, Rotterdam, and Stockholm Convention Secretary will be briefing you. This was scheduled earlier, so this is a rescheduled press conference. You already received the press roundup at the tail end of their high-level segment last week. This is going to note this press conference will mark the end of this important gathering over the last few weeks. So that's this Friday at 12 o'clock. That's it from me. Any questions? Comments? Nope. On that note, I wish you a good afternoon. Bon appétit. See you here on Friday. Thank you.